I saw this story this morning about Taylor Swift and how they can't manage to accommodate all the demand for her tickets. And I was looking and thinking, how jealous is Donald Trump of Taylor Swift right now? Welcome to The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos, and this is the first episode of a new weekly politics roundtable hosted by myself and my colleagues Jane Mayer and Susan Glasser. Hello to you both.
Hey, great to be with you.
Hi, guys.
So each week, of course, we're going to be meeting to talk about American politics as seen from Washington, D.C. And for better or worse, our first topic really chose itself.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
Jane, Susan, here we are again. It's Friday morning, and before we get to Trump, we have to talk about something that's just happened in the last 24 hours, and that is this astonishing piece of news out of Congress, Nancy Pelosi saying that she will not stay on as Speaker. And it feels like a fitting moment that she was, after all, Donald Trump's bête noire, and here she is at the very moment that he is struggling to regain stature. She is relinquishing her power. What did you think of the announcement?
I felt, oh, it's the end of an era. This is the most remarkable woman and the most successful congressional leader in memory, really. I mean, she had such a grip on her caucus and she handles it so well. And what a contrast it's going to be to presumably Kevin McCarthy if he becomes the Speaker of a tiny majority of Republicans. I just think, you know, you're sort of seeing the last efficient leader and chaos is looming.
What's amazing, Jane, is that actually McCarthy would end up having a majority very similar to the narrow majority that Pelosi had the last couple years. But because Pelosi has been such a dominant figure in the Democratic caucus and able to keep her party together and unified through a lot of strong headwinds, it doesn't seem like as hard of a job because she made it look easy. And that's the thing, Evan, that really strikes me is that, you know, Nancy Pelosi was underestimated again and again and again. And in some ways, she was sort of a genius at playing off the, you know, and trolling men with their wrong assumptions about her. You know, she was seen as non-threatening in a way that made her an incredible threat. And Donald Trump was only the latest in a long line of male politicians who made that mistake with Nancy Pelosi. But she had his number. And, you know, her advantage, in fact, as the mom and the grandma, you know, who saw him for the imperious toddler that he was, I think was one of her great contributions to American politics the last few years.
Yeah, and underestimated is the word. It sort of happened over and over again with her. And I'm curious, Jane, do you think now that she's going to be in this unusual position where she's going to be still in Congress but not the Speaker, does she retain power? Is she the person who still is pulling the levers?
I think she's going to have tremendous influence no matter what. I really do. I mean, she's not leaving Congress, you know, and the people who are likely to be the leadership on the Democratic side are her mentees, basically. So I don't see her relinquishing power completely.
But how does that work in practice? Because she said yesterday, Speaker Pelosi, outgoing Speaker Pelosi, said she doesn't want to be, she used this metaphor, like the mother-in-law in the kitchen on Thanksgiving who's constantly providing unwanted advice. But that's going to be a tricky line to walk, I imagine.
Yeah, you know, I mean, look, Hakeem Jeffries is going to establish his own leadership of the Democratic caucus. He has been preparing for this for the last several years. He's a very polished and practiced politician. He understands the caucus. He understands how Nancy Pelosi governed, I think. He's going to do it his own way. And I don't know. I'm skeptical. I think when you move on in politics. And that's part of, you know, what we'll be talking about with the the impetuous toddler down in Mar-a-Lago today. But I, you know, look, it's an amazing fact that Pelosi hang on as long as she did. She became the first woman speaker more than a decade ago, and was the first person since Sam Rayburn in the 50s to actually lose the speakership and then come back to it. There's only so many times, you can keep that going. And I do think that, you know, there's a frustration that's palpable whenever you speak with voters around the country, or even, frankly, many in Washington itself, right? It's time to move on. How is it that in this big, vast country of ours, you know, we have a leadership in both parties that is both geriatric and stuck in place? So I think it's going to be seen as a welcome move and a time to move on.
There's a sort of element of sexism here, though. I mean, I have to say about the aging issue, which is she is only, I think, a year or two older than Mitch McConnell. And nobody says, oh, he's too old and to be the leader of the Senate. He's got all kinds of health problems. They don't even discuss it with him. At least they are beginning to talk about this, of course, about Biden. But Nancy Pelosi, I think she was wise to step aside. You know, it shows a kind of wisdom about and a certain kind of recognition that the future should have fresh leadership, and I think that's great that she's endorsed that. But I am wondering why nobody asks this about Mitch McConnell.
Well, one person who is fighting as hard as possible against generational change is Donald J. Trump. And of course, we saw him this week give this announcement at his club in Palm Beach that it went on, as everybody knows, forever. It went on over an hour. I mean, there was actually video of people trying to make it towards the door to leave while he was still talking in the background, and they barred the door in effect to prevent the crowd from evacuating. I'm curious what each of you saw in that speech. What struck you about it, Jane?
I thought he looked bored and boring. And meandering. I thought his mojo had run out quite a bit. I'm not sure whether other people would see it the same way. One of the phrases that I thought was quite interesting was when he talked about there being a pause, and that what he's been going through is a pause, as if, the time had stood still and it's just waiting for him to come back while he's been down in Mar-a-Lago. No mention of the unpleasant events, such as losing the election, that resulted him in being down there in Florida.
And one of the beautiful things of the pause, if there is such a thing, is a beautiful thing, but one of the important factors of the pause is that we see how bad they've done. So we will be able to do it properly, and it will be much easier. Everybody will agree with us, because everybody sees what a bad job has been done during this 2-year period, and it will be a 4-year period. Everybody sees.
You know, I was thinking about that phrase, the pause, and it reminded me that he's a huge fan of TiVo and of watching television. And it's sort of as if he thinks he's like pressed the pause button and he can come right back into action. And in fact, kind of America's moved on in a lot of ways. Not completely. I mean, it's not to say that you don't expect to see him possibly, getting the Republican nomination. But it's not the same country, and it wasn't just paused. Somebody beat him.
Susan, what do you think?
Well, look, one thing to note is that after the midterm elections, he's been, chastened, beat up, called Trumpty Dumpty on the front page of the New York Post. And so he was trying to stick to this, sort of very dishonest, cliche-written speech that his advisors had stuffed in the teleprompter for him. And, that really is not a winning formula for Donald Trump. And so I would expect that pretty soon he'll be back to his, sort of uncensored rally self. He was told clearly that election denialism is a loser. You got to at least pretend that you have a program for this election. And so I think that was the kind of the failed effort of the speech. But, Trump is not aiming at us. You know, his audience for this speech is not the Washington commentariat. He doesn't care if we think he was bad. In fact, that will just become another grievance, is how all the snotty elites are beating up on him. And, you know, the key fact to understand is that Trump is a product of the Republican Party and his own very successful hostile takeover of the Republican Party. That's a phrase that Jared Kushner once used in an interview with us to talk about what happened here. And until the Republican Party lets him go, it doesn't really matter what we think. And in 2016, the entire establishment, including lots of pockets of the Murdoch media empire, was against Donald Trump in the primaries, but he beat 17 other candidates. Division and the ambitions of many different individuals helped that to happen. The Republican Party had a choice at every step along the way whether to go along with him, just as they had a choice after January 6th, but they chose not to. And I think that that's the part that we don't really understand yet. You know, a divided Republican Party could easily renominate Donald Trump. It doesn't matter what kind of speech he gave, but it was an amazing optic, Evan. Not only were there people, you know, clamoring to get out, but he couldn't even get his own family to show up for this. You know, Jared and Ivanka are not only out of the campaign, but Ivanka stepped on her own father's news cycle by putting out a statement that same night saying, oh, well, actually, I'm going to take a pass, not just on the announcement, but on the entire campaign.
I don't think there was a single sitting member of Congress there either. You know, Gates somehow found a last minute conflict.
He would have loved to have been there.
He blamed the weather, and we all saw the weather was perfectly fine.
I have to tell you, the scene that struck me, the moment that really stayed, was when he walked out from backstage and everybody in front was holding up their phones. And that's obviously a kind of routine artifact of this moment, except what was so interesting was it was all these people with layers of phones clearly taking lousy pictures of people in front of them taking pictures of Trump. And the reason why I mention it is that they were doing that for a very obvious reason, which is they wanted to be able to then text and tweet those photos to others to show that they had been there, which tells me something, which is that this was a club event in the fullest sense of the word, not just that it was at Mar-a-Lago, but like the Trump phenomenon is increasingly a club enterprise, meaning it's inward looking, it's self-referential, it's performing for one another. And the question that poses for me is whether that is an electoral strategy, because in the beginning it was not that. It was actually this outward facing thing. Am I misreading it, do you think?
You know, I think you're making a really important point, which is the third general election around, let's just say Donald Trump manages to win the nomination in a divided Republican Party. It's hard to imagine any American who didn't already like Donald Trump, who wasn't already part of the MAGA faithful, is going to be attracted to him a third time, right? Like, people have had so many opportunities to evaluate him. It's really hard to see him expanding upon his vote. And now he lost the popular vote, not once, but twice, by millions and millions of votes. So I think you're right that as an electoral strategy, it's a pretty risky one for Republicans.
I mean, every now and then he would refer during the speech to, instead of speaking about himself, which is, of course, his major interest, he would talk about you, the people, we, the movement. Mm. He was trying to make it seem like something larger than himself, but it seemed very manufactured, I thought, you know?
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it, in 2016, you remember the reporting showed us that that his campaign actually hired extras from a film casting company in order to fill out the room. So they were paying people to be there. This time around, the people in the room, more or less, were paying customers of Mar-a-Lago, which just confirms in some sense the sort of fundamentally the business here. But the business is kind of inverted. It's now inward facing. Susan, what do you think?
Well, you know, yeah, when we went to interview Trump in Mar-a-Lago for our book last year, that was the thing that really struck me, in fact, is that he's Napoleon and Elba, but if Napoleon was a banquet hall greeter. And right. he sits there, right? And he's doing this interview for the book in the lobby of Mar-a-Lago. And there's literally a sign as you walk in that's like, sign up for Mother's Day brunch now, you know? And then there's Donald Trump performing for the paying guests. And when we went to see him the second time, we had to go to his now famous office, you know, where the classified documents were seized, because the entire club had been bought out by an Iranian American dad who was having his daughter's over the top lavish wedding there. And Trump was bragging to us about how many millions of dollars this guy was paying to buy Mar-a-Lago. And that's what he really cared about. It was a, you know, it was like in the cartoons, you know, his eyes lit up with dollar figures.
Is it a campaign or is it a shakedown? It's right. sort of hard to know sometimes.
I mean, it's a business. Honestly, to me, he strikes me more now as like the Siegfried and Roy of American politics. You have this devoted group of lifelong fans that'll go wherever he goes, but that doesn't get you elected president. Okay, we have to talk about one of the reasons why he may. Well, am I wrong about that?
Well, no, I had one. I have another question about all of this, which is, I mean, I think you guys are absolutely right in saying that the, you know, his fans are still devoted to him, but they, and that it's the base of the party that has been convincing the leadership of the party they have to stick with him. But is he still, you know, the winning ticket? Because that's what's really been holding the leadership of the party to him. Or is he now a loser? Mm. And he's, you know, I mean, in the Murdoch empire, such as it is, has been denouncing him in the Wall Street Journal as a loser. And this is what we're beginning to see some of the big donors saying. You know, we saw Ken Griffin, the CEO of Citadel Capital, you know, one of the, by far the biggest donors on the Republican side, one of the very top ones, saying, you know, Trump's now a three-time loser. Time to move on. You know, you're seeing these sort of cutthroat finance guys saying, you know, sell the stock.
He's a wasting asset.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm wondering if he's no longer got the aura of being a necessity in order for the top people to win, will they stick by him?
Well, again, Donald Trump never really came to power because of those people in the first place, Jane, right? He doesn't need the big money people. He's built this, you know, kind of grifting fundraising operation. He's turned election denialism, in fact, into a business model these last couple years. And, you know, what's striking is how these are the same folks who, many of them, who were castigating Donald Trump after January 6th. You know, I think that the answer is, if no other alternative presents itself that's strong enough to knock him off in the primaries, they will potentially fall in line once again. It's not necessarily a winning philosophy. We got a moment here when, Stephen Schwartzman and Bernie Sanders agree on something, which is that, Donald Trump is a loser. And I think, you know, it just, what I would say is that they have followed him over a cliff and become a different party. And so the question is, can anyone else capture the electorate? You're seeing an enormous effort right now, a very calculated effort, it strikes me, by the kind of establishment and the elite of the Republican Party to break away from Trump, right? And so you're seeing that with the Murdoch empire. You're seeing that with some of the members of Congress who are suggesting it's, you know, time to move on and not have grievances. Even some members of Trump's administration, like the, you know, obsequious Mike Pompeo and Mike Pence, are suggesting that they would run against him. But again, that is still from the top down, the effort to kind of create Ron DeSantis as a kind of heir of Trump without the baggage. But what we haven't seen is whether that will work in terms of the electorate. The other point that's important to make is that we're doing all this analysis now in the conditions that we have. Listen to Donald Trump's speech. He's banking on the economy getting much worse. He's banking on there being a recession next year that's shaping the contours of the campaign. And he's banking on the idea that he got in early to the field in order to, basically make other people not run. And the conditions that the electorate may be facing when they make this decision about Donald Trump could be very different than we are now. Look at the massive layoffs in some sectors that are already happening. Is that the prelude to recession? Certainly corporate America seems to expect that's where we're headed. And so we just don't know what the political horizon looks like when it's actually time for voting.
Yeah, I have to say that's rather chillingly persuasive, actually, now that you frame it in those terms.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's one of the, I mean, of course, I'll wind up being the Charlie Brown who keeps falling for the
sorry,
with the football.
Hopefully nobody's about recording this, but go on. Yeah.
Thinking that, you know, that Trump may be finally, we might be able to move beyond him. I mean, one of the dynamics, and you know, you can argue this either way, but there is an off-ramp here with DeSantis. I mean, and that's what the big money is certainly seeing. They're saying, we can get our tax cuts and all those policies we want. We can get Trumpism without Trump. And, hey, let's go for that. Better deal. Because we might win with that, and we're afraid we might lose with Trump. You know, so there is a kind of a rising alternative. And as Susan says, there were, what, 17 other Republicans or something running in 2016, and Trump just knocked them straight off the playing field, unbelievably. You know, will he do that again now that we know who he is and how much more toxic he is? I just don't, you know, I think it's possible that he's going to have a harder sell.
A question about DeSantis.
Right. But remember, we knew who he was then. We knew who he was then, too.
We did.
Yes, his rivals, Jane, said he was a kook. They said he was crazy. They said he was unfit for office. Jeb Bush said he's a chaos candidate who will be a chaos president. They had an accurate read on Donald Trump, and the voters went for him anyway.
The political scene will be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
You probably saw recently there was this ad that DeSantis put out, which the ad was called God Made a Fighter. And it was sort of describing DeSantis as a kind of sort of semi-divine offering to the American voter. I was struck by how ham-fisted it was. I mean, this was a strange piece of political technology that they were pushing out.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a protector. So God made a fighter. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, kiss his family goodbye, travel thousands of miles for no other reason than to serve the people, to save their jobs, their livelihoods, their liberty, their happiness.
That was an unbelievable ad. It was so scary for a country that's supposed to have a separation between church and state.
Yeah.
I mean, and he basically was saying, God has elected me to be president. I am the chosen one.
Yeah.
You know, and
It had this Charlton Heston kind of narrator saying, on the eighth day, God made a fighter. And then there's Ron DeSantis on the screen. I mean,
the thing is, I think it's what's very interesting about it is that people aren't paying enough attention probably to the organization of the far-right religious groups that are now becoming such a big part of the Republican election machine.
That's interesting.
And turning out the vote through these churches and organizing them and religious radio. It's a tremendously important part of the Republican muscle right now. And that's what he's kind of speaking to, I think.
Yeah. And that's what's fascinating. I agree with Jane. I think that that is a key constituency that's up for grabs in the Republican primaries for 2024. But what's so interesting is that we had another candidate this week who basically all but came out and said he's running, and exactly in that lane. He would be competing with DeSantis for the sort of God vote, if you will. And I'm talking about Mike Pence, the former vice president, who clearly has suggested to many that he's running despite seeming to have no chance in the polls. And again, that leaves an opportunity for Trump in the primaries. Let them fight it out. Let there be many people who are competing after that. And I think, by the way, it's not the best of Donald Trump's many nicknames, but that ad is the reason why Trump already nicknamed DeSantis Ron DeSanctimonious because of that ad. And again, it just, if there's one thing that Trump's rise taught me, it was to be humble about understanding where the Republican primary electorate is going to go. And again and again and again, we all had that experience, right, of watching Trump fulminating on stage in a debate. And then the next day, boom, you know, they loved him. He was the winner.
He may not have been elected if he didn't have the evangelical vote behind him. Mm. I mean, and that was one of the things that really carried him over. And the way that he won them over, we all know now, was his transaction, which was, I'll give you the Supreme Court. I'll give you the judges who are anti-abortion, and you can back me. And the evangelical movement obviously recognizes that he's not one of them. He hasn't lived a life that is you know,
without sin. He wears
without
his faith
sin.
Lightly, yes, is what we
he
might
wears
say.
Faith very lightly. But they call him God's wrecking ball, and they're very happy to have him doing their wrecking for them. And so the question, I think it would be quite interesting to see what happens if it's a choice between him and someone who really has been devoted to sort of evangelical Christianity and the right wing sort of understanding of it. Who is Mike Pence?
You know, I'm reading right now this quote to exactly Jane's excellent point from a former spiritual advisor to Donald Trump, quoted in the Washington Post, quote, he used us to win the White House. We had to close our mouths and eyes when he said things that horrified us. I cannot do that anymore.
One of the other big questions around a Trump campaign return is what it means for the many investigations that are surrounding him. I think all of us are seeing an element of his decision making and the idea that this might insulate him somehow. He's obviously facing Justice Department investigation into the documents that were found at Mar-a-Lago that he was holding on to. There's the January 6th investigations. There's also the criminal investigation into whether he tampered with the 2020 election results in Georgia. Jane, what do you think is the implication? What is the meaning of his campaign when it comes to those investigations? Does it actually provide any legal protection, either formally or informally?
Well, it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think the answer is that it will make no difference to Merrick Garland, the attorney general. He has made so clear that he doesn't want politics to be part of his Justice Department. But I would recommend people take a look, if they want to figure out if it's a strong case coming out of Mar-a-Lago, at a 169-page prosecution report. It's like a memo for the prosecutors that appeared on a website called Just Security that has all the details and explains exactly how he could be criminally charged for taking the classified documents, and then for obstructing justice down there. So, you know, I mean, I think there it looks like there's the potential for a strong case. I don't see his candidacy stopping that in any way or really making that much difference. But I'll tell you where it could make a difference, which is a wild thing. But we know that the Justice Department has interpreted the Constitution in such a way that they've said that you can't criminally prosecute a sitting president. And so one lawyer said to me, who's followed this closely, that if they follow that, there's the possibility that even if Trump were Nice. Indicted, and maybe even if he were convicted and incarcerated, if he were to win on January 21st, 2025, at 12:01 afternoon, he would have to be released from prison or the prosecution would have to be called off. Which
I'm sorry, if you can't see me, I've climbed under the desk and I'm just in a fetal position trying to absorb that prospect. Susan, what do you think? Is his campaign a kind of Hail Mary pass that can prevent him from this fate?
Here's the thing. Donald Trump clearly seems to believe, whether it's true or not, that this offers him some sort of a magic get out of indictment free card to be a declared candidate for president. And the scenario that perhaps is more realistic, at least in the short term, than that scenario is a scenario where the Justice Department looks at this and says there is enough here to be a potential conflict of interest and to undermine the public perception of the independence of our Justice Department, and that therefore Merrick Garland thinks that he needs to appoint a special counsel to review the material that's already been investigated of Trump and to come to the decision about whether or not to charge him. And that, of course, could significantly delay the timetable of both the January 6th investigation related to Trump's role, and also, you know, even more urgently, the documents investigation. And I think that is a very real scenario. I think there would be a pretty big outcry, certainly among Democrats and those who've wondered how it is that Donald Trump manages, in their view, to avoid accountability again and again and again. But Donald Trump, you know, is so practiced at the art of using the legal system against itself to run out the clock. You know, they're still litigating over whether or not he actually has to produce his tax returns to the House Ways and Means Committee. They litigated so long that now the Republicans are going to take over the House Ways and Means Committee, and that will become moot. Donald Trump is so adept at buying for time and using the system. And Merrick Garland, by all accounts, an extremely careful and cautious figure, may decide that the integrity of the Justice Department requires him to take the step now of appointing a special counsel. And you know what? Donald Trump's calculation in that sense might have been correct.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it is a perverse fact that Joe Biden came into this presidency determined to try to stay as far away as he could from the question of his role in prosecuting his predecessor. And yet we're now at a situation where his direct competitor in the election might be somebody who is facing the possibility of prosecution. And there's nothing really that Biden can do beyond asserting that he doesn't want to have anything to do with it. And, whether or not you appoint an additional prosecutor to do that, I think there is going to be this feeling among the public that this feels like Biden v. Trump, not only in the campaign, but also in the courtroom. And it's not clear to me whether there's anything the president can do to avoid that problem.
It would create a kind of a curious situation, though, wouldn't it, if Merrick Garland feels he has to have an independent counsel to investigate Trump, but not an independent counsel to investigate the president's son, Hunter
Yeah.
Biden, who is under investigation, we know, by the Justice Department as we speak. I've seen an awful lot of lawyers speak up against this idea of an independent counsel for the reason that Susan mentions, which is there's almost nothing slower in the grindingly slow gears of Washington than an independent counsel. I mean, we've seen them just drag on for years. And we all know that, you know, I mean, justice delayed is sometimes justice denied.
Well, that's right. And Evan's point, I think, is an important one as well, which is this idea of Biden v. Trump, Trump v. Biden. This is absolutely how Trump wants to frame this election. You know, forget about any pesky Republican primary challengers who might emerge. In his speech, he again and again in Mar-a-Lago referred to Biden and not to any potential rivals in the Republican field. And I think that, you know, he needs an enemy. He needs to be a victim no matter what, he's going to find a way to do that. But to the point about a special counsel, and, you know, one of the reasons, presumably, that Merrick Garland would choose to do that would be in order to secure the public sense of independence and integrity of the Justice Department. But Trump, we saw him run this play before. And remember, Donald Trump is a 76-year-old man who has no new plays. So if you want to know what he's going to do, you know, look at the playbook for what he's already used. And what did he do to Robert Mueller, the special counsel, when he was president? He turned him into a partisan lightning rod and, you know, a figure we can all repeat the mantra by heart, you know, about Russia, 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 and the seven angry Democrats. And, it, you know, he successfully sought to tear down the reputation of the special counsel and to make it a partisan thing. And I think, you know, we know that's exactly what he would do. So even, you know, Garland may do it, but it's not going to succeed in separating out the actions of this counsel from the Biden administration anyways.
No, it's so naive, really, in a way, for the Democrats to think that they can sort of seem like they're above politics when they're dealing with somebody like Trump. He's just going to scream witch hunt again. You know, we know this. So,
You know, one of the things that's kind of lurking in the background here that I think we haven't really said head on is what this means for the Democratic Party. I mean, look, if Donald Trump runs, no Democrat is going to say this particularly loudly. But is he actually the best possible candidate for them to run against? Because we know the parameters, we know the definition, we know the boundaries of his movement, we know the direction of travel, which is kind of further and further away from the center of gravity. Are Democrats rejoicing about this guy?
I want to see what Susan says about this, because I know that you see him as just so potent. And so I'm curious, what do you think?
Well, look, Donald Trump unites the Democrats and divides the Republicans at this moment in time. And there's no question of that. There's an amazing quote from the folksy Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana, quoting The Godfather today, saying, well, you know, we need to have a war every 8 or 10 years or so to get rid of the bad blood that builds up. Republicans look like they're headed towards a version of that war. And Democrats certainly... you know, that's how they ended up with Joe Biden as their nominee in the first place in 2020. What united them around Joe Biden was the more existential threat, as they saw it, of Donald Trump. The Democrats are very ideologically divided and have not really, in the last couple of years, reconciled those divisions at all. So what remains uniting is the threat of Trump and the Trumpified Republican Party that has essentially radicalized itself and rejected core parts of, you know, kind of the American democratic system. So I think in the short term, Democrats perceive that as a good thing. But, you know, you're playing with fire. Be careful what you wish for. You know, this is we have seen how this dynamic played out before. We don't know the answers to some of the key questions yet, like what's the economy going to be like in 2024? What's the, you know, is Biden going to be the nominee? He is turning 80 this weekend, and he would be 86 years old at the end of a second term in office. He already was the oldest president ever. So, you know, there's so many kind of X factors. But, you know, remember, it was a very controversial strategy. Democrats basically spent money supporting some of the more extreme Trumpist nominees in this past election. Many of them lost, but it was a close call. You know, when somebody like Carrie Lake in Arizona comes within a couple points and you know, thousands of votes of becoming the governor of a major swing state, you know, are you really comfortable with that? I mean, the danger is that we overinterpret in politics the last war. And in this divided country, we take 50-50 or 51-49 outcomes and we turn them into massive narratives about momentum and huge sweeping zeitgeist. If you changed 100,000 votes in this country in the right places, we'd be talking about the red tide. And, you know, it's worth remembering that.
At the moment, I'll probably regret this, but I would say that Trump might be more defeatable for the Democrats than somebody who's new and fresh and younger. One thing that Trump does is he kind of neutralizes the age issue with Biden, because he's not a whole lot younger than Biden is, just a couple of years, and he's in bad shape, and he's been around now. So I may regret it, but I think he might, you know, that he might be easier to beat than someone fresh and new.
Well, we're going to listen to this tape again in 2 years, and we'll see how we did. I think we, in that spirit, we actually have to take a minute here and reflect on the role of the media, because, you know, one of the things that the 2016 campaign and the 2020 campaign to some degree taught us was a degree of humility, or it should have taught us a degree of humility about what we can really know and not know. And I'm curious how you both are thinking about that, this question of what lessons all of us should be taking from the last few years, particularly in the 2016 campaign, about how to cover Trump. You know, what is worth making news and what is not, and how should we talk about the content versus the spectacle? Do you feel like we've changed, or should have changed, or will change how we're going to cover him?
I mean, I personally have found Trump very challenging, because I come out of a tradition of reporting that tries to not inject a ton of my own opinion, but just make the reporting tell the story. And which means describing the person and quoting the person and, you know, looking into their background and all of those sort of traditional methods. And they don't really quite meet the moment when you're dealing with a demagogue, because it gives them too much latitude in a way. And so I have found it very challenging and have, you know, tried to change a little. I mean, traditionally, you would not start a story by saying Trump and then comma, who launched an insurrection and shredded the Constitution and lied for 4 years as president, has decided to throw his hat in the ring again, because it would be too prejudicial. But in a way, that's what NPR did when they described him running for, you know,
and
his announcement.
And a lot of people cheered it, because
and
they
I think
said, that's
in a way,
it
it's sort of what you have to do. You have to bring more context and for the reader than you ordinarily would, even if it's prejudicial, because it's true. And you've got to get at the truth of who this man is and keep reminding people.
Susan, what do
you
think?
Yeah, I agree. I agree with Jane very much. I mean, you know, when we were working on this history of Trump in the White House, one thing I was struck by was the extent to which you have to capture the spectacle and the Trump clown show, or you're not giving an accurate picture of the presidency. But at the same time, again and again and again, it tended to obscure, you know, the seriousness of his assault on American institutions over 4 years. And so it's not an either or option. And for too many people, it was too easy to kind of focus on the clown show. They just, even many of Trump's opponents, many of his critics, both journalistic critics and political critics, they were really shocked in a way by Trump's post-election conduct after November 3rd, 2020, even though he'd been telling them very clearly what he was going to do, even though for months and really for years, even though he had already filed lawsuits and had the Republican Party infrastructure geared up to attack the legitimacy of the elections, even though he'd signaled very clearly he would never concede, there was still a kind of a shock that I think caused us to underestimate again and again the nature of the threat. Trump seriously considered extraordinary measures to stay in power and to overturn the results of the election, including having a five-hour meeting at the White House on December 18, 2020 to talk about martial law. And so I think, you know, again, getting it right, this balance between the spectacle and the show, which is important to understanding his political appeal and how he manipulates everyone, including the media, but not at the expense of the facts and the reporting and, you know, documenting what's really going on. And so I think that's just an incredible challenge, especially in a campaign where what we see is the show.
I was just curious about you, Evan. I mean, the temptation, the wish is you could do what the New York Post did and just play him on page 26 and say Florida man decides to, you know, says he wants to run for president. But, you know, which is just, you know, a kind of genius put down. But can you really do that? Well, I mean, you can't really, right? I mean, so how about you?
I think what I'm reminded of is that the experience we just had in the midterms, for me, one of the lessons was don't underestimate the intelligence of the American electorate and the decency on some level. Look, people, they were motivated partly by they were angry about their gas prices, they're angry about inflation. But in the end, they were also angry about a fundamental rollback of abortion rights. They were angry about a genuine threat to the future of democracy. And I think in some ways, the experience of the last 6 or 7 years in politics has made me a little bit more earnest about it, to say sometimes people really do just want politics to be about governing and about getting things accomplished, and they don't really want to have it take up so much of our psychic real estate. And in that regard, I think we have to evaluate Trump on the merits, the moral merits, the legal merits, and then also be able to talk about the horse race. But for me, it is a reminder that that people can make decisions that are beyond the most fearful and cynical political calculations when they step into the ballot box, and that's encouraging.
You're an
optimist. Am I being naive?
I don't know. I was close to throwing in the towel.
It was a close-run thing, guys.
people I know in Washington were looking for property in Portugal. They were thinking dual citizenship. Time has come. So I don't know. It seemed unnervingly close.
Well, Jane, Susan, it is a pleasure as always to talk with you, and we'll be seeing each other again next week.
Well, that's something to look forward to.
You know, we don't need Washington Bureau meetings anymore now that we get to talk to each other each week on the political scene.
Hear, hear. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Evan Osnos. The show is produced with special help today from Rhiannon Corby. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brown. Thanks so much for listening.